The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and tonight we're going to talk about an institution that exists in just about every town in America. It's the public library. And since the town we're in is New York, we'll go visit the largest public library system in the country with Tony Marks, the president and CEO of the New York Public Library, who tells us one of the major reasons people come to their main reading room at 42nd Street.
Most of them are not using our books, which is the only reason you need to be in that room. They're using their computers, even though we'll lend you a computer if you don't have one. We do that in all of our branches. They're there because they might need the collection, but they're there because it's inspiring to be in a beautiful public space with your fellow citizens instead of being home alone. We're human beings. We're not cavemen. We want to be with other people, especially when we're doing the somewhat lonely work of the mind, if you will.
And then you'll hear from Dune Ives, the executive director of Lonely Whale. And this environmental organization tries to reach their audience in a slightly different way.
What we're really trying to sell by using integrated marketing tactics and campaign tactics like a global corporate brand would is we're trying to sell you a healthy ocean. Mm-hmm. So that means we take a little bit more of a lighthearted approach, still being very science-based with a grounded call to action that has measurable impact. But we speak to you the way that you want to be spoken to.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, June 9th. According to the USDA, about 12% of the population qualified as food insecure, meaning their access to adequate food is limited by lack of money and other resources. That's about 15 million households, a number that has remained basically static over the last few years. College enrollment declined 1.7% this spring relative to the spring of 2018. New Zealand already ranks as one of the happiest countries in the world, but it could be doing better. And the government's new budget is now designed around improving the well-being of its citizens, not single-mindedly focused on the country's economic growth. A study of nearly 3,000 fourth, fifth, and sixth graders revealed a connection between midday napping and greater happiness, self-control, and grit, fewer behavioral problems, and higher IQ. The most robust findings were associated with academic achievement, according to the study from the University of Pennsylvania. Doctors in the U.S. experience symptoms of burnout at almost twice the rate of other workers, often citing as contributors the long hours, a fear of being sued, and having to deal with growing bureaucracy. And finally, Justin Sun, founder of the blockchain platform Tron, is this year's winner of the annual eBay charity auction to have lunch with Warren Buffett. Sun bid a record-setting $4.5 million to win the auction, which benefits the San Francisco-based nonprofit Glide Foundation. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back with Tony Marks of the New York Public Library right after this.
A simple smile can say so much. It can say thank you, please, or even I love you. Sometimes a smile can say more than words could ever express. But what if you couldn't smile? Unfortunately, that's the sad reality for so many children today. Without the help of life-saving surgery, helpless children find themselves cast aside and all alone. But it doesn't have to be this way. To learn how you can help Smile Train, the world's largest cleft charity, change the world one smile at a time, go to smiletrain.org. Do you know someone who's dealing with a serious illness or injury? Researchers at Kessler Foundation in West Orange, New Jersey, are studying new treatments for people with brain injury, breast cancer, multiple sclerosis, osteoarthritis, and spinal cord injury. They need volunteers with these conditions, as well as healthy volunteers to serve as controls. To learn more, call Kessler Foundation at 844-KF-STUDY. That's 844-KF-STUDY. KF Study. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from the Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
Can
pundits confidently forecast the demise of one institution or another because of advances in science and technology. But often, that not only doesn't happen, but the exact opposite occurs. For instance, with the advent of the digital and the internet age, the need for libraries would no longer exist. They had served us well, but their time had come and gone. That proved not to be the case. In fact, libraries today are more vital and central to the life of the community than they have ever been. Here to discuss that and much more with us is the head of the nation's largest library system. He is Tony Marks, the president and CEO of the New York Public Library. Good evening, Tony, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
The New York Public Library was founded back in 1895. Share with us some of the history of the institution, Tony.
Sure. So the library was founded by the richest man in New York, Mr. Astor, the greatest collector in New York, Mr. Lennox, and the most powerful politician of the time, Mr. Tilden, who should have been president of the United States. And they created the New York Public Library as a research library, as a private foundation. I'm the president of the Astor Lennox Tilden Trust. And that was going to be their collection at the amazing building that everybody knows on 42nd and 5th. Mm-hmm. But then along came then the next richest man in the world, not just New York, Mr. Carnegie. And Carnegie said, let's build branch libraries. I'll pay to build them for the city of New York. It was the largest gift in the history of philanthropy even today.
Wow.
If you take it to current dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I'll build the libraries. The city will give me land. It was more than 100 years ago, so there was still land. And but the city has to pay to operate the branches. But I'm not giving the money to the city. I'm giving it to this private foundation, and the private foundation will run the libraries for New York, which is a very unusual circumstance. It means that we're not a public agency. We're a private foundation doing the work of the research library, like the Library of Congress, more used research library than any in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest system of branch libraries. There's no place else that combines those two. And it's just amazing. And, you know, I think Mr. Carnegie was right. I mean, he understood that as an institution, we're going to need private money. About almost half of our funding comes privately from the Carnegies of today. And more than half comes from the city and a bit from the state as well. So we're a very strange hybrid organization. But as you say, never been used more. The public libraries of the city, five boroughs, about 215 of them, we get almost 40 million visits a year, which is more than all the museums and sporting teams combined in this town. It's amazing. People thought libraries were ending. They've never been used more. Circulation, hours, programs, number of branches, you know, visits, all of it. It is through the roof.
Wrong again. Another one of those forecasts.
Yeah, that's great.
Didn't pan out.
The life of the mind is still alive.
You know, you have dedicated your entire career to education. And before assuming this role, you were the president of Amherst College. And much of that was inspired by a trip you took to South Africa in the mid-1980s. Tell us about that trip.
So I'd been involved in the South African divestment movement in college just because that was the hot thing, and I'd never been to South Africa, had no contact with it.
Mm-hmm.
But after I'd graduated and worked for a few years at Penn at the University of Pennsylvania in Philly, I decided to go to South Africa. It was 84. The country was about to go into a civil war, basically.
Yep.
I was, I think, the only non-embassy or CIA American in the country. At least that's the way it felt. Worked for an education group. Helped them to set up a college that gave 1 year of quality education after 12 years of terrible apartheid education, and sent 1,000 students on to the greatest universities in the land, which previously they couldn't get into because apartheid made sure that they didn't have the qualifications. It was a life-changing experience. I saw what it meant to be in a country where people were willing to die for what they believed in, for what we take for granted in the United States. Maybe we shouldn't anymore, but we did. And also, I saw the power of education.
Yeah.
I saw that 1 year of quality can undo a dozen years or more, a lifetime of purposefully bad education in South Africa for black South Africans. And my life has never been
the same.
Never been
Absolutely.
The same. I mean, that power, I don't see anything else that can make the world better compared to education in any form.
Let's talk a little bit about the physical space,
sure.
The 215 buildings you have. And
4 million square feet.
Oh, right. My goodness. Why do most people go to the library?
So I actually think it differs, mm-hmm. and that's fine, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we've got millions of people to serve. I think the first thing to notice is if you came to the main building, the Rose Main Reading Room, I think the most beautiful public room in the city.
And you're prejudiced.
I am prejudiced, yes. And most of those people look like they have another place to be, the truth mm-hmm. is. And most of them are not using our books, which is the only reason you need to be in that room. They're using their computers, even though we'll lend you a computer if you don't have one. We do that in all of our branches. They're there because they might need the collection, but they're there because it's inspiring to be in a beautiful public space with your fellow citizens instead of being home alone. We're human beings. We're not cavemen. We want to be with other people, especially when we're doing the somewhat lonely work of the mind, if you will. Then if you go to the South Bronx, the poorest congressional district in the United States, 10 minutes by subway from the third richest congressional district in the United States, the Upper East Side, those folks are there for some of the same reasons, but also because probably many of them don't have a quiet place at home
mm-hmm.
or books or computers. 2 to 3 million New Yorkers can't afford broadband at home. What we take for granted, I carry it in my pocket. They don't have. They come to the library. We lend it for them to take home now, 10,000 people at a time. But people come for lots of different reasons. People don't have books at home. You know, the poorest of America, of New York, don't have books at home. We fill that void, as well as computers and amazing librarians who, without being asked, will help you figure out what you want to learn about. It's amazing. I mean, foreigners have always come to the library first stop because we're the place that is respectful and, you know, we don't ask for any credentials. We don't care who you are. We don't care whether you can read or whether you're a Nobel laureate. We'll help you regardless. The immigrants come to the library first, and that's amazing, right? At a moment in history when, let's just say, we seem to be less welcoming of immigrants, even though we are a country of immigrants.
And those librarians do seem to be the very nicest people in the entire world. And I've heard that from so many.
It is amazing. I mean, I'm a very lucky person to work where I do.
Yeah.
People say, oh, it must be great to walk in between the lions every day. The truth is I walk in between the garbage dumpsters. I walk in through the loading dock. But the people at the library, everyone, the librarians, the security staff,
special
the maintenance
group.
Staff, I mean, they are totally into what they're doing. You know, that doesn't happen enough. That's great.
Yeah, it really
I
is.
Love them. Right?
Let's talk a little bit more of what you just had mentioned, and that is a common civic space, because so much of what we're doing these days is virtual and it's online that people physically don't get together the way they used to. And the library is one of the last places where that happens. How do you think of the role of the library as becoming that common civic space and how it can serve the community and the people living there?
We think of it as a third space, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
People, most people have home, luxurious or not.
Yeah.
Work space, luxurious or not. The library is a third space. It's your space. What's amazing about the library is no one's required to come, even though millions come. That means we must be doing something that people want. I like that, right? You know, people, you know, if we were running a school system, we could require you to come to class. And whether we did a good job or not wouldn't matter. if so, we are the largest provider of free English language instruction mm-hmm. in New York, citizenship classes, legal services. We're the largest free provider of computer training up to coding in New York. We're the largest pre-K literacy training, close to 1 million visits to that a year. And none of it is required. So if we're not doing a good job, people aren't going to come. And that's a great discipline that you know, a school system or a university, for that matter, doesn't have.
Right? Yeah, well, it's self-motivated learning.
Right.
Which
that's
you
right.
don't have in school here. It's mandatory here.
Which means
here.
Whatever people need or want, which is fabulous. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we not only do we give people, for instance, skills for jobs, whether it's language, computer, what have you, reading, we'll help you find a job, too. So across the street from the main building is the Mid-Manhattan Library. That was the central branch library of New York, what I used in high school.
That's what I used.
I never dared to walk into the main building. It was way too intimidating.
Too daunting.
But I spent a lot of time at the Mid-Manhattan, and it was a dump.
Mm-hmm.
And it had been a dump pretty much for its entire 50 years. And we are now about to finish a $200 million gut renovation of that building. And it is going to be unbelievable.
Oh,
full
that'd be done.
Floor. So December or January of – so December 19 or January 20.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the hard opening, probably a little – we'll wait till better weather, May maybe. But it's going to have a full floor of children and kids room. It's going to have an amazing ground floor and then three stories of our largest branch library with a five-story wall of books in front of an atrium that's just going to be unbelievable, twice the seating space we had before, a full floor of adult education for job skills in particular, a full floor of a business library, let us help you find a job. We have job fairs at the library or create a business. And then on top, where there used to be just air conditioning, is a 300-person amazing program space and what I think is the only free public roof terrace in New York overlooking the main building, connecting the two. It's just going to be incredible.
It does sound pretty cool. You know, one other program we haven't touched on yet is your after-school program. Tell us about that.
So we get about 30 or 40,000 kids in our branches after school every day. And when I arrived, what I noticed was, you know, a lot of computer games being played. My son spent his entire middle school killing millions of virtual people. And he seems to have come out all right. So I get it. But it did seem like a waste. We had no formal programs mm-hmm. for kids after you did the we've massively increased preschool literacy, but we had nothing for after that. And now we have after-school programs. We're going to create homework help programs. We are just starting a college advising system throughout the libraries. So, you know, kids in the public schools are not getting the kind of college counseling that, you know, my kids get naturally at home. So we're going to do that at the library. At Amherst, I was, you know, one of the things we did was, importantly, was triple low-income enrollment mm-hmm. into the, you know, top-ranked, richest, whitest college in the land. We need to help kids in New York find those opportunities. So we will.
Yeah.
And we've just announced a great new hire. I have amazing people who work with me, just amazing. Every one of them way smarter than I am, which is absolutely as it should be. I know
absolutely
that's a low. I know
be.
That's a low bar, but you know the. So we've just hired the person to run the branch libraries and the education programs. So that's the vast majority of our employees and of our efforts. And Brian Bannon is joining us. He was commissioner, CEO of the Chicago Public Library
right.
System. He was at the Gates Foundation and Seattle and San Francisco libraries. So I'm sure with Brian's leadership, we're going to do even more. We're changing what it means to be a library.
Well, you've gone from passive to proactive, haven't
That's
you?
Right. That's right. So it used we are still passive.
Yeah,
right? The civic
right.
space,
mm-hmm.
the books, the computers, the librarians, essential. But now we've almost doubled our physical space we're spending about $1 billion at the moment on physical renovations, including the Mid-Manhattan, including the Schwarzman Building, the main building, but $500 million throughout the system in the poorest neighborhoods. And that has become the education space. Whatever any neighborhood needs, we will try to provide. And if we can find partners who know how to do it better, we're happy to do that too.
You know, before we leave the physical space and talk digital, you have a pretty cool historical collection of artifacts and documents.
55 million items,
yeah,
yes.
55 million. Share, not all, but maybe two or three.
Oh, so we have unbelievable things. I had no idea, literally no idea, even though I'm a born and bred New Yorker. We have the only copy of the letter from Christopher Columbus to King Ferdinand in 1492 saying,
no kidding.
I think I found something. We have the one of two copies in the world of the Declaration of Independence in Jefferson's hand with his edits. We have Winnie the Pooh, and I don't mean the book. We have that too. We have the bear, the actual bear and his friends. All of these amazing. We have the original Bill of Rights. I mean, just ridiculous. You know, thanks largely to Mr. Lennox, the great collector of his age. But the public has never seen these things. I didn't know we had them. We're going to put them all on permanent display in the Gottesman Hall right off Fifth Avenue. When you walk right in, you'll walk right into it for free. It will be the most visited room per square inch in the city of New York. And we're going to create a new entrance to the main building so we can invite every high school student to come see the treasures of the library and then teach them what a library can do, because kids, including my kids, don't know anymore why they need a library. We've got competition, a la the digital we're about to move into.
Yeah.
And we have to compete. We can't just sit and assume everyone will do what they've always done. The world has changed, so we're changing.
How cool is that? When is that exhibit going to be?
I think it's I think that'll be 2020 as well.
Oh, that sounds great.
Which is also the 125th anniversary of the library.
That
so
is
we're
right.
going to have quite the party.
And you know, you talked about partnering before. Some of those partnerships include the Department of Corrections and Homeless Services. Now, what are you doing with them?
Sure. So, look, you know, people say, "Oh, what about the homeless in the libraries?" And my answer is, that's fabulous. What you don't want them sitting or eating and, you know, trying to think about, you know, their lives and being respected. We do all of that for the homeless, and we work with the city's agencies, the homeless, and all the agencies, basically. The other example, so it was homeless and what was your other?
Corrections.
Corrections. So for 40 years, we've sort of taken little carts of books around Rikers and the other facilities. But that wasn't good enough. So we've opened a physical library on Rikers Island.
Good for
we've
you.
We've just opened another one at the Manhattan Detention Center. Those are amazing. I mean, the guards volunteer. The guards bring books in to contribute to the collection. It's just unbelievable, right? And we have to invest in the future of these people's lives, right? If we throw them away, they will behave accordingly.
Yeah.
So we're trying to do better. But we're partnering with the public school system. Mm-hmm. So we're the biggest library system in America. New York has the biggest
public school system
in America. And we'd never talk to each other.
Incredible.
So when I arrived, the chancellor, then Dennis Walcott, now my colleague at Queens Library, he said, look, we can't afford libraries in the schools. We're spending all of our money on teachers instead. I said, well, that's funny. I got 55 million items, most of which are sitting on a shelf most of the time. Maybe we could help each other. And so now more than half the schools in New York have computers linked to us. A teacher can order up to 100 books at a time on whatever subject they're studying that month. We'll bring them physically and create a library in the classroom. And when you're done with that subject, we'll take it and we'll bring you the next ones. Everybody wins.
Everybody
right?
wins.
Everybody wins. It's great, right?
Well, this
it just means being creative, right?
Yeah.
It just means talking to each other, right?
Absolutely. You don't even know where you're going sometimes, but you come out the other end and say, hey, we could do this together. Well, this is an exciting time also because you're transitioning to the digital age. Well, all this physical stuff that we just talked about is going on. And let me pick up on what you said before about 2 to 3 million kids in this city do not
people, I should say,
do not have broadband at home. Wow, that's quite the digital divide. What are you doing to help address that?
So the story I love to tell is I was in the Bronx maybe 6:30 on a beautiful afternoon and leaving a branch. It was it had just closed, and there was a kid sitting on the stoop with the oldest laptop I've ever seen. And I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm doing my math homework. It's online. It's assigned. I have to do it." I said, "That's great. Why the hell are you sitting here?" And he said, "Because we can't afford broadband at home. I come and take bleed out of the building from the library." I thought, oh, my God, New York, the information capital of the world. And kids are picking up crumbs to do the homework we want them to do to succeed. That's crazy. Turns out there are, I don't know, maybe 50 million Americans in this situation. So we started. We raised money from Google. We got some federal money. We were then working with the FCC, though I'd say those days are over at the moment. We said we'll lend 10,000 people Wi-Fi at home for up to a year at a time. And we thought in demonstrating that there was a solution to the digital divide, that that could become a federal-funded solution. Mm-hmm. I don't think the federal government is interested in that right now. So, you know, we continue. But I will say we are frustrated that, you know, this just can't be,
right?
And you
asked
about...
We even took that to Kansas and Maine, too, as part of a proof of concept,
did. I think that was probably the first and maybe only time in the history of the library where I raised money for the Kansas and Maine library systems. And that was simply because the FCC folks said to me and the White House said to me, this was under President Obama, they said, if you've got a solution to digital divide, you have to prove that it doesn't just work in that wacko city you call home. You have to prove that it works in other places. So we raised the money and we did it in Kansas and Maine. Why not? Right? Good for them. But the point is, you know, look, we are a physical facility, essentially, and a collection, essentially. But the world is turning to these devices that I'm fortunate enough to carry in my pocket. That means we need a catalog that can find you anything. It means, so for instance, we have a chunk of our collection is situated off-site. Mm-hmm. You know, every major library, that's true. Ours happens to be in Princeton. We share it with Princeton, Columbia, and now Harvard. And you can read those books digitally if you ask, or we'll send them to you. We've actually just doubled the size of the most used research library in the world because the Harvard, Columbia, and Princeton collections have now merged with our collection. So the public in New York has access to the greatest private university library collections. That's never happened before. But you can also do it online, and that's what people want to do. So we need a catalog that can help you search, a catalog that can tell you it's coming from Princeton, it'll be here tomorrow. Or here it is online.
Well, speaking online, where do we stand with the digitization of books? And what role are you guys playing with that?
So you'll remember that, you know, Google early on said, we're going to scan every book.
I do recall.
Including they scanned close to a million of ours. And we want every book available to anyone online for free through Google. And the Supreme Court said, excuse me, copyright is in the Constitution, which it is. You've ignored it, so we're going to stop you. You can show two sentences.
Two sentences, right.
Two sentences is a pretty – I mean, you can't come up with a better sort of anecdote of superficiality, right, than, you know, the world is – you know, humanity has written 100 million books. Congratulations, you can read two sentences from this book. That's ridiculous. We want to do what Google couldn't do, what the court wouldn't do, which means we have to make deals with authors, which is why I was at the Authors Guild, for instance, last night.
Mm-hmm.
We're working with them. We actually believe that we now have a path that in the next few years will get us on the way towards every book, any book, for anyone in the world.
Mm.
I'm talking to South Africa because, as you said, I have a debt to that country.
Yes.
And a love. That may be our first global move. But we will, you can right now, you can download the Simply E app that we came up with from the App Store on your phone. You can sign up for the New York Public Library for a card on your phone. And you can, in two clicks, read up any one of 100,000 books on that app.
It used to be 25 clicks or something. You're down to
it
two?
It was 25 clicks. We're down to two. That took some work. We've offered this app to every library in America for free.
Mm-hmm.
And our job, is to go from 100,000 titles to 100 million titles to every book. And that will require figuring out what's in the public domain.
Yep.
What we didn't know was in the public domain, but is, and we're working with the Library of Congress, which, you know, for a couple hundred years has been sort of using quill pens, and we're now digitizing the copyright records of the Library of Congress. So we'll find more books that we can do that for free.
Mm-hmm.
Then we made deals with the major publishers for the stuff that's in copyright in print. We pay licenses. We have to.
Yep.
Right? And so will Akron Library or Soweto Library. But the vast majority of books written in the 20th century are in copyright but out of print.
Mm-hmm.
We have one of the few copies of those books. But if you can't come to 42nd Street and Fifth Avenue, you're
don't
out
do
of
you
luck.
Much good. Yeah.
So we're working with the Authors Guild to figure out how we can make rights deals with those rights holders, how we can offer books for people to read digitally that no one is reading because no one has access to them. And then we'll find the rights holder if people are interested. I mean, so it's going to be complicated,
yeah.
But we can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And because we're a library, the biggest library, we can and should lead the way in this. And it will be a revolution in access to quality information, the likes of which the world has never seen.
That is one ambitious undertaking. That's
why,
for
why
sure.
not, right?
Yeah,
it's New York.
Not?
It's
what else
New
do we
York,
have to do?
Right?
You know?
Right.
Tony, where do we currently stand with net neutrality, and what will libraries and the people who use them lose if net neutrality is lost?
So Tim Wu, who invented the term, who's a friend and a colleague and a professor at Columbia Law School, Tim is better at this than I am, of course, but the net neutrality basically says everyone should get roughly equal levels of service.
Mm-hmm.
And when net neutrality goes away, which is what the FCC is working on
right.
at the moment, you'll be able to get the fast lane if you can afford it, and everyone else will be consigned to the slow lane.
Mm-hmm.
We're worried about that. We want everyone to have access to all the world's information.
The fast lane.
That's what we do, right? And the fast lane, right. The I actually think the country has to step up on the digital divide issue. Look, this is my personal belief. My personal belief is in the United States, or let's start with New York, if you used every public building in this city and you put up broadband, providers, on the top of those buildings, you could create a level of access, universal,
mm-hmm.
online. It doesn't have to be all the bells and whistles. And if, you want the bells and whistles, you could buy them. Thank you very much. And the providers will want to sell them to you. But everyone should have a basic utility level. It should be like water.
Yeah.
And that's perfectly doable. We just don't seem to have the appetite for it at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
In the city or in the country.
You have said that the New York Public Library has fewer institutional constraints than many other organizations of your size. Explain what you mean by that, Tony, and how does that work to your advantage?
So I was a college president.
Yes.
Everything that a college does, appropriately
goes
enough,
to a committee.
Goes through a committee.
Yeah,
I don't got those committees.
Oh.
It's amazing. I don't have a faculty.
You didn't even know how to act at first. You must have been thinking about committees when you first started
this
job. I did.
The story about the kid in the Bronx with when I went back to my office
sure.
and realized that there were 2 to 3 million, the first thing I thought was, what committee do I need to go to? And then I realized, and my fellow college presidents hate this story, I realized I didn't need anyone's permission.
Oh.
I could do what I want. We don't have a faculty. We don't have a teachers union. The fundamental way to describe this is, there's no regulations
mm-hmm.
about what a library has to do. because no one thought it would ever change.
Yeah.
So they didn't bother, right? Mm-hmm. The school system has regulations. You know, I'm sure it's 6 feet high, although if you could put it in a book.
So you can really innovate.
We can. I mean, we are rethinking what a library means, and we're the biggest in the city at the center of the world. And you know, if we say, okay, we're going to still be passive, but we're also going to be proactive with the education programs. We're going to spend $1 billion to fix up our branches, especially in the poorest neighborhoods. We're going to open the research library, the main building. We also have the Library for Performing Arts in the Schomburg at Harlem. We're going to open those to the public. We're going to invite the treasures. And we're going to put it all online. Hmm. And those are massive transformations. And basically, if we can figure out how to do it and how to pay for it, we can do it.
That's your only constraint.
And you know, there are few jobs like mine where that's true.
Mm-hmm.
And that's amazing. I mean, you know, it makes it all the more important that we do it right, that I have, you know, people working with me who are way smarter than me, who can tell me when I'm come up with a stupid idea.
But it provides great energy to an organization
absolutely.
When you know those possibilities exist and they're not going to be stopped because
look, I don't want to overstate.
No.
We are constrained primarily in one way, which is financial.
Mm-hmm.
So again, we have about a $350 million operating budget. $200 million or so comes from the city. Thank you to the mayor and the city council. About 20 comes from the state. About 50 to 60 comes return from an endowment that we've built up over the course of a century. And if I can't raise, call it $80 million a year.
Can't do these things.
We got a problem.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
If we want to do more, we have to raise more.
And you may also have a problem with some of this public funding, right?
Say it again.
You may have a problem with some of this public funding.
Yeah, so we've had the best years of city funding in history. We've had the biggest year of private funding in our history just in the last few years. We had gotten away from what we called the budget dance, where every year, this is mostly before I arrived at the library, the budget would be threatened with a cut. Then the city would say, okay, we won't cut you. Then everyone would say, thank God, but we wouldn't get any more money.
Right.
And sometimes we got less money.
And you would do the same thing the next year.
And by the way, we have more branches. We're adding more branches, more square feet, more hours, mm-hmm. more days, more services, largely requested by the city. So we're the biggest provider of the municipal ID program or the work with the public schools or the work with, you know, with Rikers and the Manhattan Detention Center. All of that, you know, we've taken McCombs Bridge when I arrived was one of the poorest neighborhoods in New York, had a 600 square foot library, like a studio apartment. It was ridiculous. We're moving across the street to five times the space, but that mm-hmm. costs money. We have to run that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's true throughout the systems. And this year, the city, for the first time in years, has said, we're going to cut the libraries. They've already taken a $3 million cut for just the New York Public, so $8 or $9 million across the city. We have $8 million that we got last year from the city council that's not baseline. So if we don't get that, that's a cut. And the city is threatening a cut beyond that. We won't be able to do what New Yorkers need us to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's sort of funny because everybody, you know, the library is the most used institution in this town. And yet everybody sort of takes it for granted.
Sure.
And don't really understand why it's important or what would be lost if it went away. I don't want to find that out.
No.
And my job, our job, is to convince our friends in City Hall, City Council, Mayor, everyone in the administration to say, this year we need an increase of funding just to pay for what we have taken on,
mm-hmm.
which we're proud to have taken on, to serve the city and its citizens.
You know,
I'm worried we may not get it.
Yeah,
I really am. It's really scary right now.
What can people do?
Write to the mayor.
Mm-hmm.
Write to your city councilman, councilmen or women.
Do something.
People need to hear from New Yorkers.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. You know, this is different than philanthropy in the way that you usually, you know, I'm sure, talk about. I mean, we are so grateful for our private donors, for foundations, and you know, it's amazing what we've been able to do. But the citizens of New York need to step up and say,
be heard.
This is important to us. Just because we take it for granted doesn't mean we can let it go.
Where do we stand with libraries across the country? We've talked about all the exciting things that are happening here in New York City, and it's a very progressive and proactive institution. How would you describe the way libraries are faring across this country of ours?
You know, I think libraries are hurting because of fiscal squeezes from mm-hmm. their municipal sources of funds. But there are 17,000 libraries in New York, in America. And, you know, they are, you know, the lifeblood of every community. And, you know, I think it's fair to say a lot of them look to us. You know, so as we've moved into education, the sector of libraries has moved into education. As we've made the digital provision of books available, we're offering that to every library in the country. And every library will have to decide what they want to do. We can't afford to pay the costs of everyone in Ohio reading what they want to read. The people in Ohio have to decide that.
That's right.
But we've got 40 or 50 people in our digital office, which is probably more than all libraries in the world combined.
Yeah.
We can build things that work, and we can offer them to our colleagues, and we're happy to do that. I mean, mm-hmm. that's our job in part.
Let me close with this, Tony. You know, at the end of the day, the heart of your work is to impact people's lives for the better. Can you share with us a story where that has been the case?
There's so many stories. I will tell my colleagues will smile when they hear this because they've heard this story before, but it's one of my favorites. So I grew up in Washington Heights, Inwood.
Mm-hmm.
My dad didn't go to college. I went to public school. You know, nothing fancy. Sort of amazing, you know, some of the parts of my life now. So in Washington Heights, as true of many of our libraries, it was a four-story Carnegie mansion, if you will, beautiful building. When I arrived, pretty much in all those Carnegies, the basement and the top floor were empty. We just didn't have the resources. We're changing that. We're fixing that up. We're using the basements typically as classrooms for our education
right.
programs. The top floors, interestingly, were all custodial apartments
mm-hmm.
Because back in the, you know, in the day, people lived in those custodial apartments and shoveled coal
right.
to keep the library warm.
Mm-hmm.
So I go to Washington Heights. We've spent, I don't know, millions of dollars to turn that apartment into an amazing teen center, computer lab, you know, just amazing things. We do the, you know, give the usual boring speeches and cut ribbons and do things that I do. And then a guy in the back of the elegant mid-70s gray beard African-American gentleman raises his hand and says, "Can I say something?" I say, "Yeah, sure. I don't know who you are, but sure."
Yeah.
He says, "I'm Mr. Clark, and my father was the custodian here, and I grew up where you're currently sitting. And every night when the library closed, I went down and had the library to myself."
Oh, wow.
"I might have well have been a millionaire." Uh-huh. "I had the most amazing library. And I sat in Washington Heights reading books about how to build boats mm-hmm. and navigate by the stars." And then he says, "Based on that, I became the first person in my family to graduate from high school, college, grad school."
Mm-hmm.
"I became an administrator, as I recall, of a city health agency of some sort. And when I retired, I remembered, and I built that boat, and I navigated by the stars." When he said that, I was like, "Oh my God! Oh my God! Like this, you know." And the whole the city. This is what makes New York amazing.
Mm-hmm.
We are the center of the world, forgive me, I'm a New Yorker, because of the diversity of experience and talent that we have here. The library is committed to putting that into play. Let's be clear. The future of our economy, the future of our democracy, our future rests on one simple fact. Can we engage the mental capacity of our friends and family and fellow citizens? Or are we ready to give it up and let it go down the drain of diversions on screens of invidious comparison?
Mm-hmm.
The library is committed to making sure that you have quality information, that you have access to it, that you can use it to build your life as you will, and that New York can benefit from this amazing mix of talent and intelligence. That's been the secret of our success. And if we don't maintain it, it will be the secret of something very different.
So
we won't let that happen.
And what a sweet story to end on. Well, Tony Marks, the president and CEO of the New York Public Library, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Boy, you have so much to offer. For those who have not yet availed themselves of all these wonderful resources, where would you suggest they start?
Oh, my God. Well, go online, nypl.com, or come to any branch. You know, look it up. There's one in, you know, within walking distance of wherever you are, or come into the main building.
And you know what? If you get a library card, that also provides you free access to a bunch of cultural institutions and museums.
So
correct?
We now have the Culture Pass, so free access to the great museums as well. Of course,
just keeps on more and more. Well, Tony, it was a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Before you give to charity, go to charitynavigator.org. Charity Navigator provides free ratings of thousands of America's largest charities, helping you get the most out of your charitable dollar. Charitynavigator.org, your guide to intelligent giving.
Upstart CoLab is a new national collaboration connecting artists, impact investors, and social entrepreneurs. Upstart's mission is to create more opportunities for artist innovators to deliver social impact at scale. Follow them on Twitter at Upstart CoLab. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
There are some 20,000 environmental groups in this country, but one that has really captured people's imagination is Lonely Whale. And to find out how they have done it and what they're up to, it's a pleasure to have with us their executive director, Dune Ives. Good evening, Dune, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
So Lonely Whale is not just some catchy name. There actually is a lonely whale swimming around somewhere in the Pacific. Tell us about him. And why is he so lonely?
That's right. There is a whale. It's thought to be a cross between a blue and a fin whale that has been swimming the Pacific Ocean, presumably his entire 35 to 40 years, by himself, calling out at a frequency of 52 hertz that no other whale has been known to call out before since he was found. And he's, you know, male whales call for companionship, that's the theory. And so one can imagine that his entire life he's calling for companionship, never once hearing a call back. And all the while, what we're doing as humans is we're making it really hard for him to survive, let alone thrive, when eventually, hopefully, he finds his one true love. And that was the genesis of Lonely Whale. People, once they heard the story, came together and wanted to know what they could do. How could they be a part of this? How could they really help this lonely whale survive and find companionship? Because really, at the end of the day, that's what it's all about, is connecting.
Yeah. What is the importance of the ocean to our survival, and particularly how it relates to climate change?
Well, the ocean is our great carbon sink that most people don't even recognize that it exists on a daily basis. It's thought that the ocean has absorbed about 90% of our carbon emissions. It gives us every second breath that we take. And it provides food for, gosh, a billion people around the world with seafood. And so what we're doing right now to the ocean is we're making it hot. We're making it acidic. We are experiencing now about 90% of the world's fisheries, either fully fished or overfished. And so we're really at a tipping point with whether or not the ocean can continue to sustain life as we know it.
Yeah. You know, despite all of that, people don't particularly care about the ocean as much as they should. But you've been able to connect with them in a very special way. What do you attribute that success to?
At Loney Well, we wanted to approach ocean health a little differently than maybe other NGOs have in the past. So instead of talking like scientists, although we're science-based, and instead of talking like NGOs, although we are an NGO, we took a different tact, and that was to talk and act like a leading corporate brand might, trying to sell you something like a pair of tennis shoes or a t-shirt or a car. What we're really trying to sell by using integrated marketing tactics and campaign tactics like a global corporate brand would is we're trying to sell you a healthy ocean. Mm-hmm. So that means we take a little bit more of a lighthearted approach, still being very science-based with a grounded call to action that has measurable impact. But we speak to you the way that you want to be spoken to. So we don't talk to you like a scientist would. What we do is we talk to you the way that you need to hear a message in order to pay attention and to really break through all the noise that's out there right now. So every day there's something serious happening in our world. So how do you break through with a message about ocean health and give people something that they can do to feel really powerful every day that they're making a difference? Mm-hmm. And that's really what Loney Well is grounded in, is a very simple, clear call to action delivered to you in a way that you can hear it and in a way that encourages you and supports you in becoming involved and being part of the solution.
Yeah. Well, let's take an example of one of those. And I guess if there's any such thing as a gateway plastic, it would be straws. And you have had an incredibly successful campaign addressing that issue just in the way you described. Tell us about it.
Oh, that pesky little plastic straw.
Mm-hmm.
So when we looked at all the ocean threats out there, and unfortunately the list is long, pick one, you know, pick anything and you'll make a difference. But we decided to focus on plastic pollution because it's the one thing that connects us every single day. It's almost impossible to go about your daily business without coming into contact with single-use plastic, especially single-use plastic that either can't or isn't recycled. And that includes the single-use plastic straw. So when we looked at developing a campaign to get people engaged with ocean health, we decided to start with that single-use plastic straw because for most of us, it's not needed. Now, there is an important segment of our population that needs a straw for sustenance, mm-hmm. but the vast majority of us don't need it. And so we thought, well, gosh, if we can just get people to stop sucking on a single-use plastic straw, and it's funny, maybe we can actually make a difference in terms of making people aware of the ocean and then also seeing a number of single-use plastic straws begin to be removed from our daily existence. Because really, all you need is a mouth and a cup,
right,
or some vessel, and you can drink.
Well, you have a campaign, and the hashtag to it was Stop Sucking. So tell us how this worked and who you got involved and what the results of that were.
So Stop Sucking is a campaign that we designed to really live on social media. We developed we call it a plastic service announcement, so our PSA.
Very cute.
And we got a bunch of actors and individuals who maybe you feel like you recognize from a movie or a TV show, some of whom you didn't even know. There were a few people in there who are just like you and me, just regular people.
Mm-hmm.
And we got them to admit on camera that they suck, that they suck every day. They suck in multiple countries. They just suck.
Yep.
And it was so clever that when we put it on social media, it went into more than 40 countries in just over 3 months, and it was natively localized in 25 languages. So what that told us is that people really could see themselves in it. They could customize it for themselves. They could own it and create content that they wanted to share with people within their network. This content traveled far and wide, and it still is traveling. I mean, it's really the campaign that keeps on giving.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, though, we also launched a clever campaign where we took over an entire city. We call it Strawless in Seattle, because that's funny, too.
Yeah.
From the 80s and 90s, Meg Ryan, Tom Hanks. And Strawless in Seattle saw, you know, millions of straws removed within just a few weeks. And policy being changed by the city of Seattle and Seattle Public Utilities to ban the single-use plastic straw, as well as plastic utensils that can't be recycled. And what both of these campaigns in tandem did for the movement is I think they demonstrated that people care about the issue. And they also showed that change is possible on a very large scale. That Strawless in Seattle campaign gave way to policy change all over the world. And it's been really exciting to see how much it's grown. One thing I'll share about this campaign, though, is because oftentimes we get the question of, well, aren't you worried that people are just going to stop at straws?
Mm-hmm.
They're going to do one thing and then they're not going to do anything else. And I have to say the opposite is true.
Yeah.
So once you introduce a single-use plastic straw to somebody as a concept, what they then start doing is looking around and they see single-use plastic everywhere. And they start asking questions like, well, what about that bobblehead doll I get at the Mariners game in Seattle?
Mm-hmm.
And it comes in plastic that I don't think I can recycle. Are we okay with that? Or a restaurateur in Seattle said, one of his managers said, well, what about all those clams and oysters that we get in plastic bags that we can't recycle? Why? That doesn't make any sense to us. And so what we've seen is every time somebody starts the conversation around single-use plastic straws, they go to the plastic stirrer or the pick or the bag or the water bottle or the plastic bag. And so it just allows that conversation to grow and to really take shape and to get quite a bit of lifts, not only within someone's community, but really within their country, within a region. And then you see the conversation continuing to expand around single-use plastics.
Yeah, positive spillover, I think, is what they call it. How do you feel about grocery shopping? Plastic bag, paper bag, cotton tote bag? Any advice there?
Well, I always bring my reusable bag.
Mm-hmm.
And my, you know, I know there's a question going around right now of the life cycle assessment of a plastic bag versus a reusable tote or a cotton tote. My, you know, my response is always, well, I haven't seen any whale wash up on shore that has a cotton tote in its belly. So it depends on, you know, so for me, I have a 5-year-old child. I'm not going to go to a grocery store without having something that I can bring groceries home in.
Mm-hmm.
And a reusable tote is the best option for us. Although oftentimes I will say that we use a paper bag as well because we use paper bags for our trash bags
yeah.
instead of plastic.
Mm-hmm.
So when it goes into the landfill for the, you know, small amount that goes to the landfill from our household, it's in a paper bag that can decompose. So I think everybody has to make the decision that's right for them. But ultimately, we really need to be thinking about the more than 100,000 marine animals that are thought to die every single year because of plastic entanglement or ingestion of plastic. And right now, for our ocean to remain healthy and stable and to start to rebound, we need every single one of those animals to be as healthy as they possibly can.
Absolutely. Let's close with this. Give us another one of your campaigns. You have so many innovative things on your website. I was truly blown away. Share one of them with us that has you particularly excited right at the moment.
I'm really excited about our Ocean Heroes Boot Camp.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a partnership with two other organizations, Captain Planet Foundation and Point Break Foundation. And we partner with 14 different NGOs, including the UN Environment. And at the end of June in Vancouver, British Columbia, we're bringing together more than 300 kids from over 25 countries, including 24 states in the U.S., to teach them about plastic pollution. And the reality, though, is they teach us a lot.
Yeah.
And to help them design their own single-use plastic pollution reduction campaigns and then support them when they go back out into their communities. They are going to be working with kids that are part of a larger Ocean Heroes Boot Camp program that includes meetups with Hip Hop Caucus, with the UN President of the General Assembly, with the World Sailing Trust, and with zoos and aquariums around the world. And to be honest, like, these kids give us inspiration every single day. They are tackling single-use plastics in their school cafeterias, within their communities, at a state level, with corporations. And it's really up to us to support and nurture their needs and issues. Today's fifth graders graduate in the year 2030,
mm-hmm.
when it's expected that we will have one ton of fish for one ton of plastic for every ton of fish
yeah.
in the ocean. And so it's, you know, it's our responsibility to make sure that they can create the future that they deserve.
Well, your organization has certainly done a lot. You would think you have 300 people there, and it's nothing like it. Well, Dune Ives, Executive Director of Lonely Whale, thanks so much for being here this evening. Now, for people to learn more about the organization, you have a whole host of campaigns we didn't even get a chance to get to. Or if people want to support this work, tell us about your website.
So you can go to lonelywhale.org. And on the Lonely Whale website, you can click out to all of our campaigns and initiatives, including Ocean Heroes and our Next Wave Plastics Initiative. And then our next campaign, which is HydrateLike.org,
right. yeah.
which is going to be very exciting and will launch very soon.
Well, can you say one word about that before you go?
We use 500 billion single-use plastic water bottles on an annual basis. And only 91% of all the plastic ever produced only 9% of all the plastic ever produced has been recycled. So big opportunity to make a big dent in the amount of plastic that we're producing and using on a daily basis.
Stay tuned. Can't wait to see you. Well, thanks, Dune. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks so much.
And that is this week's show. Next week, my guest will be Mike Kobzansky, Managing Director of the Omidyar Network, an organization started by the founder of eBay, Pierre Omidyar, and his wife, Pam. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. And do come back next Sunday evening for the Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of the Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.